When Lord Cornwallis surrendered the British Army at Yorktown in 1781, bringing the long, hard struggle for American independence to a victorious conclusion, Thomas Jefferson and his compatriots looked forward to establishing a brave new world in North America, a republic where not only liberty and justice would prevail, but where the arts and sciences would flourish as never before. America must show Europe that republican institutions were as favorable to science and letters as to commerce and husbandry. Every circumstance, declared Dr. David Ramsey of Charleston, South Carolina, concurs to make it probable that the arts and sciences will be cultivated, extended, and improved in independent America. When the American patriots threw off the mantle of the prophet and turned their attention to the actual condition of scientific pursuits in their country, however, they were frank to concede that the immediate prospect was not very encouraging. Although many Americans had scientific interests, the demands of politics, business, and professional life left them relatively little time for solid scientific achievement. Thomas Jefferson's wistful comment that he would have preferred to devote his life to science if the events of his time had not summoned him imperiously to public service was typical of his generation. The principal cultivators of science were, as Dr. Benjamin Smith Barton observed, professional characters who cannot, without essentially injuring their best interests, devote to these subjects that sedulous attention which they demand. Some of them, like Barton, were practicing physicians who taught in the medical schools and studied natural history or chemistry or both in their spare moments. Others were clergymen burdened with the care of parishes. Of the astronomers, some taught in the colleges, others made a living by surveying and instrument making. Several of these early American scientists had political careers as well. When time could be found for scientific research, the necessary tools were frequently lacking. The study of natural history in this country is in its infancy, wrote the Reverend Manasseh Cutler to a European correspondent in 1799. This deficiency, he went on, has been in part owing to the great scarcity of books on natural history. We have many public libraries consisting of large and well-chosen collections of books from Europe, excepting on the different branches of natural history in which there are few. And our booksellers import no books on this subject. We have no cabinets of natural history in America, excepting one in Philadelphia and another in Boston. These consist of small collections without any systematic arrangement. In like vein, Professor Benjamin Silliman, head of chemistry at Yale College, lamented the scarcity of chemical apparatus in the United States and the inability of American industry to supply the want. All this was true, yet despite the demands on their time and energy, and despite the scarcity of books and apparatus for scientific research, Jefferson and his contemporaries managed to keep abreast of the progress of science, establish scientific societies, found journals, create a taste for science among their countrymen, and participate in the scientific discovery of the New World. If they failed to emancipate American science from its provincial status, it was not for want of effort. Among the institutions that provided a stimulus to scientific activity, the colleges held an important place. It should be remembered, however, that the American College of Jefferson's time was not a research institution. Teaching was the primary, if not the sole, function of the early American college, and the professors were hard-pressed with academic duties. Natural philosophy had been the only scientific offering during the colonial period. But in Jefferson's time, chemistry and natural history began to make their way into the college curriculum by way of the medical schools. The careers of Dr. Benjamin Smith Barton at the University of Pennsylvania, Dr. Samuel Latham Mitchell at Columbia, and Dr. Benjamin Waterhouse at Harvard University illustrate this development. All of these men were trained in Europe, especially at Edinburgh. All practiced medicine and taught not only medical courses, but a variety of scientific subjects ranging from chemistry and mineralogy to botany and zoology. Mitchell also served several terms in Congress and edited the Medical Repository, which was the closest thing to a scientific journal of a general nature published in America in this period. Mitchell was an ardent champion of the new French chemistry and an investigator in several fields of natural history. He published the first geological sketch of a part of the United States and made a substantial contribution to the study of American fishes. Dr. Benjamin Smith Barton published a work on Materia Medica, a textbook of botany, a pioneer work in Indian linguistics, and numerous articles on American animals. Dr. Benjamin Waterhouse was equally diverse in his interests. He is remembered chiefly for his part in helping to introduce vaccination for smallpox in America. In general, however, these men were important more for their enthusiastic and unremitting labor in organizing and promoting the study of science than for their scientific publications. They scattered their energies too widely to make a deep impression in any single field. Likewise, although the colleges had competent professors of natural philosophy, none of these professors distinguished himself by his researches. Outside of the colleges, the main support for scientific research came from various scientific societies organized on the model of the Royal Society of London. The oldest and most active of these was the American Philosophical Society held at Philadelphia for Promoting Useful Knowledge, founded in 1743 by Benjamin Franklin and several of his associates. Reorganized and rejuvenated in the 1760s, the society published its first volume of transactions in 1771, a volume devoted largely to observations of the transit of Venus in 1769. Careful preparations had been made to observe this transit from several locations, and the resulting publication, containing not only the observations themselves, but a computation of the solar parallax by David Rittenhouse and the Reverend William Smith, drew high praise from Jean Bernoulli in his account of the progress of astronomy for the year 1771. The Revolutionary War all but extinguished the American Philosophical Society, but its activities revived with the construction of a philosophical hall in 1786. Benjamin Franklin, whose generosity helped to make the building of the hall possible, continued as president of the society until his death in 1790. He was succeeded by David Rittenhouse, the self-taught surveyor and instrument maker, whose papers on astronomy and optics had done much to lend distinction to the society's early transactions. On Rittenhouse's death in 1796, Thomas Jefferson became president of the American Philosophical Society, serving in that capacity until 1815, 6 years after he retired from the presidency of the United States. Throughout these years, Jefferson managed to contribute substantially to the work of the society, despite his heavy political duties. Philadelphia was an ideal location for a scientific society. It was the second largest city and seaport of the United States, and the capital of the nation from 1790 to 1800. There Benjamin Franklin had gone to seek his fortune, and there he and his colleagues had organized such institutions as the American Philosophical Society, the Pennsylvania Hospital, the College of Philadelphia, later called the University of Pennsylvania, and the Library Company of Philadelphia. There, too, the portrait painter Charles Wilson Peale established his Museum of Natural History, known as Peale's Museum, where visitors might view not only Peale's portraits of the heroes of the Revolution, but his Indian relics, his minerals and stuffed animals, and his skeleton of the mastodon, the first such skeleton ever exhumed and mounted. In the environs of the city were several botanical gardens, notably those of William Bartram and William Hamilton. These various scientific institutions were mutually reinforcing. Many of the faculty of the university and its medical school were members of the American Philosophical Society, and Peale's Museum was available to the students of natural history at the university. Botany throve on the interchange of information and specimens among university scholars, country gentlemen, and botanically minded clergymen. Small wonder, then, that Philadelphia became a mecca for the devotees of science in America, whether Americans or visiting Europeans. From Europe, Alexander von Humboldt, Joseph Correa de Serra, André Michaux and his son François, Joseph Priestley, Thomas Cooper, William McClure, Frederick Pursh, and the Count de Volney, to name only the most outstanding visitors, found their way to Philadelphia and to the American Philosophical Society. From Philadelphia, seafaring vessels carried a regular load of letters and specimens to Europe and brought back a return load of letters, books, and apparatus. The removal of the seat of government to Washington, D.C., in 1800 was a heavy blow to the development of Philadelphia as a cultural center, but its leadership in science continued for many years to come. Philadelphia was not without rivals in its claim to scientific distinction, however. Soon after the Revolutionary War, the Bostonians established their scientific society, known as the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and published their first volume of scientific memoirs in 1785. In due time, they found in Nathaniel Bowditch of Salem, Massachusetts, an astronomer worthy to rank alongside David Rittenhouse of Philadelphia. Like Rittenhouse, Bowditch was self-educated. He became interested in astronomy while voyaging the seven seas as a common sailor. During these voyages, he applied himself to mathematical and astronomical studies, making use of every spare moment aboard ship. The outcome of his studies was his famous American Practical Navigator, a handbook of navigation still in use in a much revised form. In theoretical astronomy, his most impressive contribution was his translation, with commentary, of Laplace's Mécanique Céleste, a performance which won him the respect of astronomers throughout the world. For many years, Bowditch's papers formed the backbone of the memoirs of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Not to be outdone by Harvard-dominated Boston, the literati of New Haven, Connecticut, formed the Connecticut Academy of Arts and Sciences in 1799, drawing heavily on the faculty of Yale College for contributions. The best known of their members was Professor Benjamin Silliman, whose American Journal of Science and Arts, founded in 1818, rapidly replaced Samuel Latham Mitchell's Medical Repository as the main scientific journal in the United States. In the southern states, Charleston, South Carolina, was the main cultural and scientific center. It boasted a museum, a college with a medical faculty, a literary and philosophical society, and several natural historians of considerable ability. It was inevitable in a new nation expanding across an unexplored continent that scientific interest should run strongly toward natural history, that is, toward the description and classification of the plants and animals, the soil, climate and minerals, and the aboriginal inhabitants of America. Although American naturalists regarded this as their special task and opportunity, the undertaking proved to be one requiring the combined efforts of American and European scientists. Americans studied abroad and sent specimens and descriptions to Europe in return for books and for expert help in solving the problems of classification. Likewise, European naturalists came to America to study its flora and fauna. Some of them returned to the Old World to publish their researches, others remained in the New. Whatever the case, the scientific discovery of America became and remained an international undertaking. In geology, The outstanding achievement was that of William McClure, a Scotch businessman and philanthropist who combined efforts at political and social reform in Spain, Mexico, and the United States with the study of natural history, especially mineralogy and geology. Accompanied by a servant, he traversed the region from Florida to Quebec in his private coach, collecting specimens of rocks and minerals at half-mile intervals, and at the same time encouraging and subsidizing others in their scientific pursuits. The outcome of these labors was his Observations on the Geology of the United States, published in the Transactions of the American Philosophical Society in 1809. Here, for the first time, the geology of the United States east of the Mississippi River was described and illustrated. McClure had earned the title Father of American Geology, which was to be bestowed on him by later writers. Even more heroic than William McClure's achievement in geology was the single-handed performance of Alexander Wilson in describing the birds of the eastern United States. Like McClure, Wilson was a Scot, but he did not enjoy McClure's educational and pecuniary advantages. Arriving in the United States in 1794 at the age of 28, with nothing but his wits, his health, a negligible reputation as a humorous poet, and a knowledge of the trade of weaving, Wilson became interested in ornithology through his acquaintance with William Bartram of Philadelphia. Encouraged by Bartram, who was himself a pioneer in the study of American birds, Wilson undertook to write and illustrate a comprehensive account of the birds of America. Gun in hand, he traveled northward, westward, and southward from Philadelphia by foot, boat, raft, horseback, stagecoach, or any other available means of transportation to secure specimens for his book, acting as his own collector, salesman, engraver, and colorer. The first volume of his American Ornithology appeared in 1808. The eighth was nearly completed when Wilson died of work on August 23, 1813. In 7 years, without patron, fortune, or recompense, Wilson had described and figured 278 species of birds, many of them never before described. His American Ornithology was an heroic achievement, worthy to be compared with the later work of John James Audubon. In the field of botany, no single figure dominated the scientific scene in the early American Republic. Instead, there was competition and cooperation among a host of botanists, American and European. In and near Philadelphia were a score of botanists and herbarists, including preeminently William Bartram, Dr. Benjamin Smith Barton, and the Reverend Henry Muhlenberg. Their efforts were seconded and stimulated by many foreign visitors, some of whom came to stay. Thomas Nuttall and Frederick Pirsch, the Michaud, father and son, the Abbe Correa de Serra, Portuguese minister to the United States, and others. In his parish at Lancaster, Pennsylvania, the Reverend Henry Muhlenberg dreamed of a botanical circle drawn from all parts of the Union, which would prepare the way for a comprehensive American flora by correspondence and by interchange of specimens and ideas. As things turned out, the description of the American flora was the work of many hands. The two Michaud, father and son, produced the first comprehensive works, The History of Oaks in 1801, The North American Flora in 1803, and The History of Forest Trees, 1810 to 1813. Frederick Pirsch, of German origins, published his Flora of North America in 1814. Thomas Nuttall, an Englishman turned American, his genera of North American plants in 1818, and Stephen Elliott of South Carolina, his sketch of the botany of Carolina and Georgia in the 1820s. Muhlenberg's long travail bore fruit in 1813 with the publication of his catalog of the hitherto known and native naturalized plants of North America. The paper of the book was rough and the typography crude, but Muhlenberg's spirit was undaunted. "Health and prosperity to all lovers of botany," he declared in the preface. A severe stroke in January 1814 failed to quench the old man's ardor. In a letter written shortly before his death, he expressed delight that the Philadelphians were enjoying the botanical lectures of the Abbé Correa de Serra. Muhlenberg died on May 23, 1815, but the impetus he had given to American botany lived on. The most dramatic of the American contributions to natural history in Jefferson's time was the discovery and exhuming of the bones of the Megalonyx and the Mastodon. Thomas Jefferson played a leading role in the first of these discoveries. Upon hearing that the bones of some giant clawed animal had been found in a cave in western Virginia by workmen excavating for saltpeter, Jefferson took immediate steps to procure these remains and published an account of them in the Transactions of the American Philosophical Society in 1799. In this account, he conjectured, erroneously, that the great claw, or megalonyx, as he called it, was a huge lion, three times the size of the African lion. His collaborator in the description of the remains, Dr. Caspar Wister of the University of Pennsylvania, came closer to the mark when he likened the animal to the sloth and to the giant animal later named the Megatherium, whose bones had been found in Paraguay and had been mounted at the Royal Museum in Madrid. Wister's conjecture was subsequently confirmed by the great French paleontologist Georges Cuvier, who classified the Megalonyx and the Megatherium as two species of a single genus belonging to the family of edentates, an intermediate between the sloths and the anteaters, but closer to the first than to the second. Cuvier based his conclusions not only on Jefferson's and Wister's accounts, but also on some plaster casts of the Megalonyx bones prepared by Charles Wilson Peale, and a single tooth procured by the wandering French naturalist Palissot de Beauvoir. The exhuming and mounting of the first skeletons of the mastodon was the work of this same Charles Wilson Peale, founder of Peale's Museum. As a matter of fact, it was the public response to the exhibition of a few mastodon bones in his portrait gallery in 1784 that had encouraged Peale to convert the gallery into a museum of natural history. It proved a difficult undertaking, but by 1800, Peale had put the museum on a sound and profitable financial basis and had made it highly useful to the cause of science. Aided by William Bartram and Alexander Wilson, he assembled a truly remarkable collection of birds, especially the birds of America. His animals were drawn from all over the world, from the ships that sailed out of Philadelphia and New York, from exchanges with European collectors and museum curators, from gifts brought in by visitors or sent by correspondents, and from the Lewis and Clark expedition, by courtesy of President Jefferson, who had sent that expedition out. But Peale's prize exhibit was the mastodon skeleton, one of two such skeletons exhumed by him in 1801 with much labor and expense in marshy ground not far from the Hudson River and mounted with the best scientific advice available in Philadelphia. The mammoth, as it was called, was a scientific as well as a popular sensation. One of the two skeletons was exhibited at Pall Mall in London and provided Cuvier with the information he needed to classify this giant incognitum, whose bones and teeth found in various parts of the world had baffled the classificatory efforts of European naturalists for more than a century. "Thanks to the Peales," wrote Cuvier, "the osteology of the American mastodon was entirely known, except for the top part of the cranium." In the fields of anthropology and ethnology, the American Indian provided a fascinating topic for research and speculation by Jefferson and his contemporaries. Where had the Indian come from? What were his racial peculiarities, his manners and customs, his linguistic traits? And how was he related to the builders of the mysterious mounds or earthworks scattered over the face of North America? Jefferson himself opened one of these mounds in a careful scientific way and wrote a report of his observations. He also collected Indian vocabularies throughout many years. Unfortunately, most of these were lost when they were shipped to Jefferson's home in Virginia after he retired from the presidency. The study of Indian linguistics did not depend on Jefferson alone, however. In Philadelphia, Dr. Benjamin Smith Barton undertook to compare the languages of the American Indians with each other and with those of the Old World, using, for the latter purpose, a lexicon of Old World languages begun by Catherine the Great and completed under the direction of Peter Simon Pallas, a German naturalist in her employ. Barton's book, entitled New Views of the Origin of the American Indians, caught the attention of German investigators, including Alexander von Humboldt and Johann Severin Vater. Vater's works, in turn, inspired the efforts of the next generation of American linguists, including Peter S. Duponceau, John Pickering, and Albert Gallatin. In summary, we may say that although American researchers failed to make brilliant theoretical or experimental contributions to the progress of science in Jefferson's day, they nevertheless played a useful and significant part in the world of science. There were no American Herschels, Laplaces, Humboldts, Cuviers, or Jussieus, but these great scientists knew and appreciated the work that was being done in America. Especially in the fields of natural history, European scientists were hungry for information and specimens from the New World. Europe had the libraries, the endowments, the herbaria, and museums for the study of systematic natural history, but the plants and animals and minerals of America could only be collected on American soil. In Jefferson's time, as in every time, science was an international enterprise. No one appreciated this fact more than Thomas Jefferson. No one was more patriotic than he, no one more convinced of the unique and glorious contribution that America would make to human progress and culture. Yet he never lost sight of the unity of Western science, never allowed the provincialism of American culture in his day to make his own outlook provincial. His example is a good one to remember in our own time.